This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica stations. Every year, Earth Day, which is April 22nd, is a marker for events and rallies around climate justice, sustainability, or green energy. This year, in the era of Donald Trump, Earth Day has taken on a greater significance. Thousands of people are expected to take to the streets of their cities in a march for science. Scientists and those who believe in protecting and promoting scientific inquiry see a deep existential threat from an administration bent on cutting research funds, as well as scapegoating immigrants, including those working in scientific fields. Attacks on science impact all of us. In one of his first acts as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Trump's appointee, Scott Pruitt, ignored the EPA's own scientific data, pointing to the dangers of a pesticide, and decided not to ban it. My guest is Alexander Odysseus Bradley. He is the lead organizer and communications director for the March for Science Los Angeles. He's also a PhD candidate studying molecular biology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome to the program, Alexander.
Thank you.
So first, what led you into becoming an organizer? It's not every day we hear about a PhD candidate in molecular biology being someone who's active in organizing. What is your impetus in this?
Sure. You know, it's not every day that you have scientists in general that are championing a political cause. The reason I got involved is that I saw a growing and imminent threat to the understanding of science at a large scale level, from really just the non-scientists and the general public all the way up to federal policymakers. And I felt that there was a real need for scientists advocating for their own data in policymaking and really championing their own data, making sure that evidence-based policy is something that drives this country. And the Science March presented itself as an excellent opportunity to do that.
We sort of imagine that science can stand on its own, right? It is a mode of thinking that applies so much rigor to research, to understanding the world we live in, that we don't imagine we need to defend this mode of studying the world in a political march. Does this need to march for science, in your opinion, arise from deep ignorance at federal levels, or this sense that science is getting in the way of making profits?
You know, I wouldn't call it ignorance. I would say it's a lack of activism at the level of scientists. You know, for a long time, I think scientists believed that it was the nuance of their work that would be lost on the general public, that would be lost on non-scientists. But we're realizing now that it's really large-scale consensus like climate change or the efficacy of vaccines that are being fundamentally misunderstood at all levels of government and in society. And this developing mistrust and misunderstanding of science is not unique to this administration or our society in the current decade. It's, I think, for a couple decades now, there's been a growing misunderstanding of science, and I think it's really important that scientists address that. We're the ones most aptly positioned to really communicate our science better to the public.
Right. This desire to note the nuance has been turned over on its head often by elites. For example, on climate change, the fact that 95%+ of climate scientists are in consensus that humans are behind the cause of global warming is exploited by the fact that these politicians can say, aha, there's still some doubt, and therefore it's still just at the level of a theory. But of course, that level of consensus is generally not present in most scientific established theories, right?
Right. Well, that's at the most fundamental level, Something that we've failed as scientists to effectively communicate to the non-scientist is the difference between a hypothesis and a theory. A theory is something that's been developed by poring through generally decades of research on a subject and finding that the consensus does clearly suggest a particular conclusion. And that's true with something like gravity. The theory of gravity has been developed through our observations of our world and the way that objects physically interact in our world. And that I don't think many people can really claim that gravity doesn't exist. If you jump, you're inevitably going to fall. And climate change is real. While day-to-day weather might confuse the general public, the global climate is changing. Our sea levels are dropping. The oceans are becoming more acidic as a result of absorbing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And there have been many experiments that have very reproducibly shown that carbon dioxide in a system such as our Earth will trap in heat. And it's a problem that we've allowed to continue for too long. And I think scientists, again, coming full circle to this necessity of championing our own data, recognize that we can't just do the experiment and ship that off to a policymaker to do the right thing with it. We really need to be representing ourselves in policy.
Alexander, verbal communication isn't always something that one can expect from many scientists. I mean, I've worked in science myself, and I have to say, just hearing you speak, you're the exception rather than the rule among scientists who are great at putting down on paper what their ideas are and what their data are, but maybe testifying in front of Congress, these are learned skills, right? I mean, these are things maybe that this sort of idea of verbal communication with the non-scientist maybe does need to be an extra skill that our scientists need.
Absolutely, I agree. And some large scientific organizations like AAAS and I know ASBMB, ASCB are all starting to recognize this need for effective science communicators.
And the AAAS, the Association, American Association for the Advancement of Science, did I get that right?
That's correct.
This is an established scientific institution, a network, and I understand that many of these science bodies and groups have actually endorsed the March for Science. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. AAAS came on pretty early once they realized our messaging was hard to not support. Science matters, fact matters, evidence should drive policy. But I think you'd be surprised by how many scientists are effective communicators. And it's been learning on the job. So I do agree that we need to emphasize the importance of science communication at an early stage. Like when you're, earning your doctoral degree, you should be learning how to communicate effectively. A lot of the responsibilities that our scientists have thrown on them once they get into like a faculty position, managing a lab, accounting, hiring employees and managing their health benefits, and also communicating to others. These are things that they aren't really prepared to and have to learn on the job.
Right.
But they requisitely must be effective communicators to go to conferences and communicate their science. I think often that message is lost on the public, though. So.
Let's talk about what is expected to happen on April 22nd. This is Earth Day. I'm assuming that was done on purpose, Earth Day being a very apt day for this kind of a political action.
Yeah, there's so many marches, a lot of causes that people are really passionate about that it was difficult to find a date that we didn't encroach on an existing march, unfortunately. And the DC group, the national group who kind of incepted this this whole event, they had decided on Earth Day. I think they had in the first couple weeks of developing their Facebook group, they had about 1,000 people email them with suggestions as far as what day the march should be held on. And something like 70% of those said Earth Day. So That's kind of where that decision came from.
I want to play for our audience a short video created by the March for Science organizers in Los Angeles that attempts to lay the groundwork for why it's important.
In my lifetime, there has never been a significant fear that tens of thousands of people would have to leave higher education because of a dramatic revision of governmental policies. Let's say $10 billion are going to be cut out of funding. Great, now you have 50,000 people who are no longer working in the sciences. We have a tremendous capacity for scientific research and for converting that into inventions, into new businesses, into new industries. And you pull 50,000 people out of that, and the whole thing shrinks and moves somewhere else, maybe.
And you've been watching a short video created by the March for Science Los Angeles about why it's so important to march. Alexander, what is it about the U.S. traditional emphasis on science that has made it a center for science worldwide? I mean, I was a 16-year-old teenager in the United Arab Emirates of Indian origin, and I wanted to study physics, and the only place that I felt was the best option for me was the United States. And I couldn't even tell you why, but I wanted to go to the US to study physics. What is it about about the emphasis on science in this country that has made it a science leader?
You know, I think as you kind of alluded, it's a difficult answer to fully grasp. I think maybe everyone has a different answer to why that is. In my opinion, it's the value that we've traditionally placed on basic research, or what scientists are trying to call fundamental research now, because basic implies kind of a negative connotation. Basic or fundamental research is just pursuing the most basic questions that we don't understand about life, about chemistry. You know, why does this protein do X in cell type Y? And sometimes those questions aren't terribly interesting to the general public. They don't necessarily understand why that would be an interesting question to pursue. But in developing answers to these incredibly nuanced and focused questions, that's where our innovation stems from. You know, if you don't understand how to make cardboard, you can't create a box. So I think that's really, for me, why I see the U.S. as traditionally having been a leader in science, is that we recognize that you can't target, you know, I want this result in science. Often science leads you down an unfortunate path of confusion until you find a unique answer, and that leads you to something else, and you can't really necessarily direct where that path is going to take you.
Now, in addition to the proposed cuts to scientific research, the Trump administration, of course, has cracked down very hard on immigration, attempted to issue twice a travel ban for people from predominantly Muslim countries. But as I mentioned, as an immigrant, what drew me to this country was science, and some of the best and brightest minds from countries around the world, particularly in the global south, come to the United States to study science. Sometimes they stay, sometimes they leave, but they often end up benefiting this nation as well. I know that among physicians, there are immigrant doctors that are disproportionately represented compared to their population, general public. There's a shortage of technical workers from other countries, both in the science and tech fields. Do these travel bans work in tandem to attack science along with the funding cuts, proposed funding cuts?
I think so. It's not a direct attack on science, but it absolutely affects the quality of science that we have here. You know, in 2016, all six science-related Nobel Prizes that the U.S. Won were awarded to immigrants. Diversity is an intrinsic an intrinsically important aspect of science. You know, we can't do good science if we have all of the same type of person pursuing the same type of questions in the same way.
And it's already having an impact. The University of California system reported for the first time in 12 years, there was a drop in applications from international students after a continuous increase every year. And so people are actually scared to come to this country now. They're less likely to want to attend American universities for fear of being targeted by this administration.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate. I don't think this is an issue that's necessarily unique to the Trump administration. I think there are some tendencies towards xenophobia that kind of a knee-jerk reaction. We want to be safe. We want to protect ourselves. We want to protect our community and what we feel is ours. And sometimes that feels challenged by a person or a culture that we don't fully understand. And I think science can absolutely inform us on that sort of issue as well. When you look at the data, it really doesn't seem to be a logical decision to ban particular countries from entering the U.S.
And right there, I think you've hit the nail on the head, that science represents logic and rationality, the opposite of fear and paranoia and irrationality. And so it really feels like this is the moment for this battle. Alexander, what was amazing about the March for Science, I understand, is that from the moment it was announced that there would be a March for Science in the very early days of this administration, there was an instant and huge public response, not just from scientists, but from non-scientists. What do you attribute that to? And how have you been heartened by the response?
You know, At the level of the non-scientist, I think it's just this this respect for what scientists do and how it's changed our lives. I mean, every day you pull this amazing computer out of your pocket and you interact with it in just fascinating ways. And you're connected to millions of people around the world.
Like you and I are connected at this moment.
Yeah, it's incredible. And that those, we would not have these technological advancements. We would not have the medicine we do. We would not have the amazing innovations that have positively affected our daily lives if we didn't have science. And I think that's really at the level of the non-scientist where the passion comes from. For me, maybe my love of science is a little more nuanced. I'm just fascinated by molecular biology, and we have physicists that are fascinated by the way lasers work, and maybe that's why they're so involved. But in the broadest sense, it's just a support of the amazing innovation that science yields. And I know that our team, our volunteer team that's producing the event here in LA, is majority non-scientists, graphic designers, videographers, marketing professionals that just want to make this event as positive and impactful as possible. And it's been incredible to work with these people and just defer to their expertise so that we can really make this an incredible event.
Let's give out details. Here in Southern California, where this program is produced and where you and I are, the March for Science Los Angeles is taking place at Pershing Square on April 22nd, and it starts at 9 a.m., goes all the way through 4 p.m. But of course, if you're outside L.A., chances are almost any city, major city you live near is likely to be hosting a March for Science, right, Alexander? And I understand the main event is in D.C.?
That's correct. And there are over 400 satellite marches, and that's global. That's not just in the United States. There are people all over the world that are, standing up in support of science, which is pretty amazing. And just to clarify, while our event does start at 9 a.m., the march and speeches, both the pre-march rally speeches and the post-march kind of call to action speeches, that will all conclude by about 1 p.m. We have a science expo that's running during and after the march, and that's going to continue until 4.
And people can find out more about the LA March at marchforsciencela.com, the general march, as well as a map to link you to marches around the country and the world, is simply marchforscience.com. www.thestreetsofla.com. Alexander, I'll see you on the streets of LA on April 22nd. Thanks so much for joining us.
Excellent. Thank you so much for talking with me.
My guest is Alexander Odysseus Bradley. He's the lead organizer and communications director of the March for Science in Los Angeles. He's also a PhD candidate studying molecular biology at UCLA. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.